Yemenis have staged rallies to mark the 6th anniversary of the Saudi-led war on their country. This day is regarded as the National Day of Resilience against the Saudi-led aggression. The war has left Yemen devastated and on the brink of famine, claiming tens of thousands of lives, displacing millions. Saudi Arabia has also imposed a blockade on Yemen, which has badly hampered humanitarian efforts. The UN says the impoverished Arab nation is facing the world's worst humanitarian crisis. In the past few weeks, the Yemeni army has launched major drone and ballistic missile attacks on Saudi Arabia's sensitive targets. The main question now, why has Saudi Arabia failed to achieve any of its objectives in Yemen over the past 6 years of its destructive war?
The Saudi-led coalition intervened in Yemen militarily in March 2015 to restore to power former President Abd Rabbu Mansour Hadi. During the years, the Saudi war machine has pounded the poorest Arab nation non-stop. To make matters worse, Saudi Arabia has imposed a blockade on the country, which has badly hampered efforts to save civilian lives. The UN regards the situation in Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The UN Humanitarian Office puts the Yemen war dead at 233,000. The toll includes 131,000 from indirect causes, such as a lack of food, health services, and infrastructure. According to the World Food Program, out of the 29 million population, over 20 million depend on some form of aid for survival. 4 million have been driven from their homes, more than 16 million face hunger this year, and the rate of child malnutrition is one of the highest in the world. Nearly half of Yemeni children under the age of 5 suffer from acute malnutrition. After 6 years of relentless violence, the kingdom has failed to bring allied politicians back to power. Political commentator Tim Anderson believes Saudi Arabia has failed to achieve any of its objectives in Yemen.
The Saudis, as the spearhead of that, if you like, have not achieved any of their objectives. They've been on retreat for some time now, and as your report points out, that's the Yemenis are pressing their advantage now that they have the upper hand.
Now, Saudi Arabia is coming under growing pressure from the international community to end the war. The new U.S. administration claims it's halted its support for the Saudi-led war, saying there is no military solution. Some European powers have also stopped or suspended arms sales to Riyadh. In the meantime, the Yemeni army launched a major drone and ballistic missile attack against the kingdom's oil infrastructure and military bases. The Saudi-led coalition is also facing intense pressure from a Yemeni offensive on the northern province of Marib. The attacks have dramatically upped the ante for the Saudis, making them feel more than ever the bitter pinch of the war. Political analyst Colin Cavill says the Yemenis have demonstrated the desire and capacity to be free from the decade-long Saudi hegemony.
The Yemeni people have already demonstrated their desire to be free, of the Saudi puppets.
The leader of Yemen's Ansar Allah movement has vowed the Yemenis will remain steadfast in resisting the Saudi-led war. Abdul Malik Badreddin al-Houthi has stressed they will continue dealing blows to the Saudis on their own soil as long as the war continues. Riyadh appears to be searching for a way out without having to offer any concession. This week, Saudis offered what they called a comprehensive ceasefire, but Yemenis rejected the proposal as nothing new. They say their attacks won't stop until Saudi Arabia stops its aggression and lifts the air and sea blockade on the country. It remains to be seen if the Saudis will find a face-saving path to exit the military quagmire before the 7th anniversary of the war.
Well, joining us on this debate, we have international human rights lawyer Daniel Kovala joining us from Pittsburgh, also from the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War. Mr. Ken Stone, joining us from Hamilton. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Kovalik in Pittsburgh. The war has destroyed much of Yemen's infrastructure and led to a famine, the worst famine to occur in 100 years, according to the United Nations, in addition to other epidemics in the impoverished country of Yemen. Why has this war been dragged out for so long?
Well, it's dragged out for so long because the Saudis have totally underestimated the capacity and the will of the Yemeni people to resist. Despite the fact that the Yemenis, as you say, have been suffering greatly through the bombardment, the U.S.-backed, we have to say that, bombardment, through the blockade, they have stood firm. And you saw pictures today of thousands and thousands of people rallying in Yemen, celebrating the fact that they have not been defeated by what should have been a greater power in Saudi Arabia, against a Saudi Arabia backed by the U.S., the U.K., and Israel. This is David having whooped Goliath's ass, okay? And the Saudis are reeling from it. And the Yemenis have proven they will fight until the last person. And it's frankly quite stunning. And the Saudis are stunned by this.
Let's bring in Mr. Ken Stone from Hamilton. Mr. Stone, if none of Riyadh's objectives have been met, does it mean that the Saudis are worse off now more than ever over the course of the 6 years of the war?
Yes, indeed. But first, I'd like to congratulate Press TV for covering the war, the Saudi war of aggression against Yemen, so diligently for the past 6 years. Unlike the mass media in the West here, which have chosen to ignore the war, and that's mainly because they don't want the people in the West to realize the havoc that has been wrought upon the people of Yemen by the arms that are being sold in the countries of the West to Saudi Arabia. So kudos to Press TV, and I believe you're living up to your motto of being the voice for the voiceless. Now, to answer the question, the Saudis are indeed worse off. They are losing this war, and they are losing it badly. They are stunned, as my colleague Dan Kovalik just said. And this is not the only war they're losing. They are losing the war in Syria, which they also funded and recruited for. And this has cost the Saudi economy hundreds of billions of dollars, if not trillions of dollars. Saudi Arabia was, until recently, one of the richest countries in the world, with money to burn on real estate in London and in the United States and all kinds of fancy jets and everything else. But now they are in deficit. Now they are in debt. And you can't expect to run a country when you lose two wars. I think it's the defeat, the debacle of losing two wars is going to put the Saudi royal family in jeopardy. It might mean the fall of the House of Saud, which could not come too soon, in my estimation.
Danny Kovalik, the United Nations says that Yemen is speeding towards the worst famine on the planet. Top UN officials have also warned that this massive famine could wipe out the fresh peace efforts, so-called peace efforts, with 16 million people going hungry across Yemen. Yet we're still witnessing international inaction to relieve the suffering of the Yemeni people. Why is that?
Because those that pull the strings, like the U.S. and the U.K. and Israel, are happy with what's happening to Yemen. They are supporting Saudi Arabia in this effort, and they are silencing people who oppose it. And as my colleague Ken said, the mass media is complicit in this. They don't report on it. Most of the world doesn't know that this war is happening, doesn't know the depths of this famine. But it has to be pointed out that when history is written about this, those who participated in this war against Yemen, which includes Barack Obama, Donald Trump, Joe Biden, will go down with the names of other people like Pol Pot in terms of starving out people. This is a disgrace. This is an evil that must stop. And that is why, again, few people talk about it, because they will not face the reality of what's happening.
Mr. Stone, on the sixth anniversary of the war, the Yemeni army launched a major drone and ballistic missile attack on Saudi Arabia. Drones and missiles targeted Aramco oil facilities in four cities. Military bases and positions were also hit as well. Talk to us about the significance of these retaliatory attacks that are being carried out by the Yemenis. Does it show how far the Saudis are from the goals that they'd set out on the onset of the war?
It absolutely does show how far the Saudis are from the goals they set out at the onset of this war. They seriously underestimated the Yemeni people, whose aim is to have self-determination. This is a popular uprising, which started back in 2014, I believe, to remove the Saudi-dominated government of Yemen. And when the Houthi people managed to overthrow this domination of the richest country in the Middle East over the poorest country in the Middle East, the Saudis responded by working with the U.S., the U.K., Israel, Canada, and many other countries, United Arab Emirates, to try and put an end to this popular uprising. And at first, I remember pictures shown on Press TV of barefoot Yemeni soldiers driving captured columns of Saudi Arabian coalition soldiers into camps after having defeated them in battle. And now the resilience of the Yemeni people, which the Saudis seriously underestimated as well, has turned into Yemeni attacks in the heartland of Saudi Arabia with drones right on their pocketbooks, hitting their petroleum facilities and their military bases right around Riyadh. It's astonishing how far the Yemeni people, which started as barefoot soldiers, have advanced in this war. The Saudis are stunned by their oncoming defeat.
Danny Kowalik, how much can these reprisal attacks change the dynamics of the war? Did the Saudis underestimate the defensive capabilities of the Yemeni forces, in your opinion?
Well, yes. And what history has shown is that when colonial or neo-colonial powers like Saudi Arabia, backed by, of course, the big colonial powers, attempt to subdue a population, despite the fact that they may have much superior air power and other military might, they generally are unable to do it. I mean, a good comparison, of course, is Vietnam, where the U.S. thought that it could defeat the Vietnamese, and every day they thought they were on the verge of victory, when in fact that victory never came. Of course, the Vietnamese defeated the French, and then the United States, and then China, and overthrew Pol Pot. I mean, you can't subdue a people for very long, and the Saudis have discovered this. And they will keep discovering this as long as they keep this war up. And I think at some point the U.S. is going to cut Saudi Arabia loose because, you know, the alliance between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia is not really a natural one. We don't have much in common except that oil. And if the Yemenis keep hurting Saudi Arabia's ability to get that oil out of the ground, the U.S. will have no use for Saudi Arabia anymore.
Ken Stone, do you agree with those comments? Skeptics believe that maybe Biden, who is an old wolf of U.S. foreign policy, isn't going to let down the U.S.-backed dictatorships in the Middle East that they've armed and supported for so long. What do you think?
I think that Saudi Arabia was one of the three pillars of U.S. hegemony over the oil-rich Middle East until 1979, when the Iran Revolution took place. Iran was one of the other pillars, and the State of Israel is the third. So Saudi Arabia could not have waged this war against Yemen without the green light from the U.S. And when Biden said that he doesn't want Saudi offensive attacks to continue on Yemen, if he really wanted this war to end, he would just turn the green light to a red light and say, stop the war now. But he hasn't done so. He said they're putting a hold on arms sales, but in fact there was a big arms sale by, I think Lockheed Martin just last month of millions of dollars worth of equipment. And the U.S. Is not taking the position that the peace movement around the world wants to see it take. Today is the global day of action to stop the war on Yemen. It's actually the second global day. There was a first global day on January 25th. and that was the biggest anti-war mobilization since Iraq. Today, people are demonstrating in many countries. In Canada, we had a car cavalcade here in Hamilton, in Ontario, and in Vancouver yesterday. Right now in London, Ontario, people are sitting on the railway tracks into the General Dynamics plant, where the light armored vehicles worth $15 billion are being sold from Canada to Saudi Arabia. It's time that the grassroots, that the peace movement, that the people of the world tell their governments, especially in the countries which are participating in and fueling this war with arms sales, that it's time to stop these arms sales. And that can help to be a factor in stopping this war, just as my colleague Dan Kovalik said about the war in Vietnam. The demonstrations around the world, the peace movement, helped to bring that war to an end. And today, the global peace movement is on the move.
Right.
And hopefully, it will help too.
Daniel Kovalik, reacting to Joe Biden's comments about wanting to stop support for the Yemeni war, Yemen's Supreme Political Council said the Yemenis will not be fooled by mere U.S. statements, and they want to see action. Why should the Yemenis even trust Washington?
Well, they shouldn't. I mean, there's no reason to. They've now lived into the third presidency of the United States that has backed this war. And, you know, it's particularly hypocritical that someone like President Obama and President Biden, who claim to be, you know, people who support human rights and liberty and all that, that they have been as supportive of this conflict as Donald Trump. This has been a bipartisan war. There is no reason to trust the United States here. Again, in the end, if the U.S. backs out of this war, it will be because, as Ken said, the people of the world have demanded it, but also because the Yemenis have forced the U.S.'s hand. That is the only thing that will stop the backing of Saudi Arabia.
Ken Stone, in a statement issued during today's rallies, Yemenis stressed they reserve the right to pursue criminal charges against their attackers. As we know, Yemeni officials have in the past called for war crimes probes. Will there be accountability for the crimes committed against the Yemeni people? How likely is that going to happen, given all the support Washington gives to Riyadh?
Unfortunately, it's not likely, because the international criminal tribunals that have been held in the past on Yugoslavia and Rwanda, other international issues, are paid for and organized by the main neocolonial powers, the EU and the US. So I'm not optimistic. Nonetheless, they should try anyway. And they should further see if they can force reparations from those countries that have participated directly in the Saudi-led coalition against the people of Yemen, and the countries that have sold arms to fuel this war, such as the governments of Canada, the U.S., the U.K., and other European countries.
And one last question for Mr. Kovalik, an issue that Mr. Stone brought up earlier. UNICEF has warned of the formation of a lost generation in Yemen. Well over 500,000 children have been forced to leave their homes as a result of this war. That's also coupled with the destruction that the Yemeni infrastructure has taken. Why is all of this being underreported in the mainstream media?
It's being underreported because those facts are quite inconvenient to the idea of American exceptionalism that most people in the U.S. and certainly most people in the media hold dearly to. And that is the idea that somehow the U.S. is this unique force for good in the world, that the U.S. military is basically a human rights organization in their view. And what's happening in Yemen totally belies that belief system. What you're seeing in Yemen exposes the brutality of U.S. foreign policy, and again, will put the U.S. Along the ranks of other criminal nations that have carried out aggressive wars. And again, as the statistics are showing, this may be one of the most brutal wars we have ever seen in modern times against largely the civilian population of Yemen. It is a disgrace that the media just cannot get its head around.
All right. Thanks, gentlemen. International human rights lawyer Daniel Cavalli joining us from Pittsburgh. Also, thanks to Mr. Ken Stone from the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War. And also, special thanks to you for staying with us on this debate. It's good night.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
وَالَّذِينَ هُمْ لِفُرُوجِهِمْ حَافِظُونَ.
And they who guard their private parts. Except from their wives or those their right hands possess, for indeed, they will not be blamed. But whoever seeks beyond that, then those are the transgressors.
Dear listeners, we were talking about the beginning part of this chapter, Chapter Mu'minun, which in the beginning part, it starts to talk about the attributes of the true believers who are from among the successful indeed. So we were talking about the 5th and 6th verses, and also the 7th one is also related. وَالَّذِينَ هُمْ لِفُرُوجِهِمْ حَافِظُونَ إِلَّا عَلَىٰ أَزْوَاجِهِمْ أَوْ مَا مَلَكَتْ أَيْمَانُهُمْ فَإِنَّهُمْ غَيْرُ مَلُومِينَ. And those who guard their private parts, save from their wives or the slaves that their right hands possess, for then verily they are not blameworthy. And the 7th verse, فَمَنِ بِتَغَى وَرَاءَ ذَلِكَ فَأُولَٰئِكَ هُمُ الْعَادُونَ. But those who crave beyond that, such are transgressors. So in the previous program, we mentioned that the sexual instinct can be the one most likely to be misused, and because of the importance of this issue, it has been emphasized on this subject in this verse. Anyway, but if the Muslims, if the true believers, use this instinct in the right way, they are غَيْرُ مَلُومِينَ. Using the Quranic phrase غَيْرُ مَلُومِينَ means they are not blameworthy, and it most likely refers to the wrong idea among the deviated Christians that consider every kind of sexual intercourse against human dignity, and they see any form of marriage stopping to reach full spiritual realization to the extent that Catholic priests, monks, and nuns remain celibate all their lives. And it is because they think marriage is something against this spiritual rank. At any rate, it is impossible to accept that Allah would create such a powerful instinct in man as a part of the wisdom and prohibit it totally or count it as against the dignity of man. Indeed, the unnaturalness of this attitude has resulted in many members of these people resorting to superstitious ways to satisfy their sexual instinct.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
So, we do not need to remind that the legality of having sexual relations with a wife is circumscribed under some certain conditions such as menstruation and the like. The legality of such relationships with slave girls has numerous conditions that are mentioned in the specific books, the books of jurisprudence. And it is not the case that every slave girl is lawful for her owner, and the same conditions that apply to wives can also apply to them in some cases. Now in this regard, let's just have a look at some narrations regarding this issue. It has been narrated from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, who said, "Indeed, a woman is a collar you put around your neck and bind yourself by it. So you should look at her closely and think carefully who is going to take control of you, and finally, where she is going to lead you. Be aware that a bad woman cannot be compared with a good one, for a good woman is more priceless than gold, silver, or any precious gem. And on the other hand, a bad woman has no value at all. She's not even equal to the soil, for the soil is indeed better than her." So, dear listeners, you can see what an important role the women play in the society based on the Islamic school of thought. It is interesting that one of the companions of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam returned to him and says, I told Imam Sadiq alayhi salam that my wife, who was in agreement with me about the affairs of the life, has died, and now I want to marry another woman. He says, the Imam told me, think well and see where you put your heart and soul, and who will be your partner in your possessions, and will be aware of your beliefs and your secrets. If you intend to get married, select a maiden who is characterized by honor and good morals, who is from a family that you know is good, chaste, and honest. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program as well. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Round the world with reporters.
EU leaders have concluded the first of a two-day virtual summit, which was dominated by the bloc's highly controversial COVID-19 vaccination program. It was confirmed during the event that more vaccines have been exported from the EU than have been administered to the bloc's own inhabitants.
Companies have to honour their contract to the European Union before they export to other regions in the world.
So the EU's ban on vaccine exports, when deemed necessary, is going ahead. But critics say the damage has already been done due to the European Commission's mismanagement to date. The leaders' summit was given official data showing just 4.1% of the EU's population have been fully vaccinated. A third wave of the coronavirus is taking hold in the 27-nation bloc. Cases are spiking, most notably in France, Poland, Italy, and Germany. Infection rate increases are being recorded in several other EU nations, including here in Belgium. This means hospital admissions are rising. More are being transferred to intensive care units. The bottom line is people are dying due to the pace of the EU's vaccination rollout program. There's economic disaster looming for millions of businesses in the EU as new lockdowns are announced. In some nations, jobs are being lost at a record rate. The tourism industry is on its knees. Citizens are frustrated.
Our government was telling that it would be better in May and the opening of the cafes, restaurants and so on. And nowadays, I don't dare make a plan.
For the moment, the situation is so difficult that everybody's complaining about everything. And I understand that. It's not easy.
Critics say the health, social and economic consequences of the EU's failures during this crisis are not yet fully clear. Analysts warn there are likely to be dire political consequences for the establishment. Jerome Hughes... Brussels.
A massive air show in Pakistan's capital, Islamabad. The armed forces flexed their muscles on the eve of Pakistan's National Day. Pakistan celebrates every year the very idea of its creation in the name of Islam over 80 years ago, when this part of the world, together with India, was under the imperial rule of the British. The significant part of the air show was the acrobatic maneuverability of warplanes known as JF Thunder. Pakistan indigenously manufactured them in cooperation with China after the US stopped the supplies of F-16 fighter jets. Pakistan is fast reducing its reliance on the US for military hardware with the growing role of China in the indigenous production of its high-tech weapons with focus on fighter jets.
Pakistan is today manufacturing the JS-17, which has excellent capabilities in a way is replacing the F-16. And if even the spares are denied to Pakistan, it seeks those from other countries or tries to manufacture it within Pakistan. US has many restrictions and sanctions. It's relying more and more on China and other European countries.
Pakistan had 4 wars with India, 3 of which over disputed Kashmir region, divided between 2 nuclear-armed neighbors in South Asia.
Pakistan is a strong nuclear-armed state. Beyond an iota of doubt, the peace in the region is linked with the fair solution of Kashmir dispute. We want to move forward with the desire of peace, but let me make it clear that our desire for peace must not be mistaken our weakness. Any misadventure against Pakistan would be responded back with a full force.
According to a study by American think tanks like Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and Simpson Center, Islamabad is far outpacing New Delhi in the development of nuclear warheads, and Pakistan would possess more nuclear weapons than any other country except Russia and US within the next 4 to 5 years. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
After more than 2 months of almost unprecedented delay, United States President Joe Biden faced journalists in his very first press conference. Biden often read from prepared notes and spoke for just an hour. He selected the reporters who could ask him questions and avoided the conservative media, which has regularly asked that he finally engage with journalists without scripted questions or aides to help him.
Biden doesn't have any. Why? I think you're... The speculation is very valid that he is in cognitive decline. They're worried that he can't, he wouldn't be able to hold up over press questioning for a while. They're worried that he won't be able to hold up if he had to give a good big speech.
Biden fielded questions on changes to voting laws and the Senate filibuster tactic, avoided questions on gun control, and said he expects to run for re-election. Even though the country is in the middle of the worst socioeconomic crisis since the Great Depression, the mainstream media journalists allowed to attend awarded the largest portion of their questions to a problem outside the country's borders, the increase of refugees from Latin America. There appeared to be very little of the often extreme combativeness and skepticism towards Biden as there was towards his predecessor, Donald Trump. During the presidential campaign, both mainstream media and social media corporations were routinely accused of giving Biden preferential treatment. Corruption allegations involving his son went ignored, while many said Biden rarely faced difficult questions.
There's the right-wing press that, of course, are going to attack him. And then there's the press that support him, and they're not going to say anything critical of him. They're not going to say anything critical of certain Democrats either.
On foreign policy, neither Iran nor Russia was mentioned. Regarding Afghanistan, Biden said it would be hard to meet the May 1st deadline set for America's total withdrawal, but he also said that he did not picture troops still occupying Afghanistan in 2022. Keeping up his antagonistic stance towards China, Biden alleged that Chinese President Xi Jinping, quote, doesn't have a democratic bone in his body. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Indian police raided and detained a family in refugee camp in the outskirts of New Delhi. Members of the community say the police detained a family of six without any reasons, giving them no chance of even having their breakfast. The whole community is terrified, and panic has gripped the entire camp about their fate.
There is an uneasy calm and a sense of fear in this refugee camp after dozens were detained in recent weeks. Now people are more fearful, anticipating their turn, which they say is inevitable after years of vicious campaigns calling for their expulsion from India.
This refugee, who did not want it to be named, says police and law enforcement agencies frequently visit their camps and ask for their details. He says the visits are more frequent since last few weeks.
We are all terrified. It looks like our legs are broken and we are just alive. Since the Indian government has started detaining our members of our community, the whole camp is gripped in fear. We can't even sleep. We are burdened to everyone and no one cares about us. We are refugees. We came here to save our lives, to save our children. And we are grateful India gave us refuge. Sincere.
Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled neighboring Bangladesh and other countries, including India, escaping genocide in their country. Estimates suggest some 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living across different states of India.
Where are we being detained? If we are a problem for India, let them send us to some other country, wherever they feel we are safe. We are already dead, since we belong to nowhere. Now this detention issue is killing us every day and night. We left our country to save our lives. And in India we found peace, despite hardships.
Rights groups have urged India to halt any deportation plan, saying conditions in Myanmar are not conducive. They say the Indian government should uphold its international obligations and protect those in need of refuge within its borders, saying India has hosted refugees from many countries since decades, but adopted an aggressive approach towards Rohingya Muslims in particular. Munawar Zaman in the outskirts of New Delhi.
In a press conference, Yemen's Eye of Humanity Center for Rights and Development revealed the number of victims of 6 years of Saudi war on the country, which has also caused massive destruction to the infrastructure of the country.
There are 43,593 civilians killed and wounded during the past 6 years. 17,097 of them were killed, including 3,821 children and 2,394 women. As for the wounded, they numbered 26,496, including 4,183 children and 2,1815 women.
The center says Saudi airstrikes targeted thousands of civilian facilities deliberately, including hospitals and schools. Meanwhile, millions of families were displaced as over 500,000 homes were ruined in more than 20 governorates.
This report monitored the crimes and violations committed by the Saudi-led coalition against civilians in Yemen, as well as the destruction and damage resulted from the brutal targeting of thousands of civilian installations, including homes, hospitals, schools, mosques, roads, bridges, and historical monuments. Even the cemeteries were not spared.
During 6 years of war, Saudi Arabia committed thousands of violations of international humanitarian law, including using internationally prohibited weapons such as cluster bombs in targeting residential areas. As the Saudi campaign against Yemen enters its seventh year, Yemen is saying Riyadh is still violating the international human rights law by holding 14 Yemeni oil ships amid the continued neglect of the international community. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana.
A moment of silence for more than 126,000 Britons who have died since the UK government announced the UK's first lockdown this time last year. And as the country prepares to exit its third, the government's handling of the crisis is being called into question. Some say the success of the vaccine rollout is being used to obscure just how unprepared the government was and how Britain has been made poorer by poor decision-making. Economists say the lowest income bracket will have to foot the bill, which may exceed £355 billion.
The taxpayer will foot almost certainly most of it, and it's 355, but then you've got the next year's borrowing, which be another 234 and another 100 on top of that, getting up to 700-800 a billion. The key point about this is that the whole of their philosophy is based on the idea that the very wealthy will trickle down their wealth to the mass of the population. That never happens.
The Public Accounts Committee said earlier this year the government's lack of economic planning and preparation for a pandemic was astonishing, despite it being one of the top risks identified in the National Risk Register. Billions have been thrown at businesses in danger of going under, and if the borrowers can't repay them, the taxpayer will.
They panic, and they are in a panic situation at the moment. They're just crossing their fingers and hoping it will go well, but they're still in panic mood, and that explains why they just shoved out the money.
There is no way of knowing how many fraudulent claims have been made, and it is forecast many businesses will not be able to repay their debt, so the British public will have to. Throughout the pandemic, the government reassured lenders who were not required to perform any credit or affordability checks by guaranteeing loans 100%. But that can't be said for the British public, that is already reeling from years of declining social mobility and a near decade of rising child poverty. Bianca Rahimi, London.
A new wave of coronavirus has started in the Gaza Strip with over 500 new infections reported on Wednesday. During February, infections were below 100 cases daily. Coronavirus infections have reached over 60,000 cases in the blockaded Gaza Strip, mostly since late August 2020. Nearly 600 deaths have also been reported amid shortages in medicines and hospital supplies, including vaccines. The unsteady supply of medical equipment and testing kits for COVID-19 has compounded the struggle of health workers in Gaza, undermining their efforts to contain and track the spread of the coronavirus.
We are witnessing an alarming increase in the number of daily infections. Coronavirus infections' current daily rate is over 500 cases. The number of patients requiring hospitalization and medical attention is also rising at a fast pace.
COVID-19 has complicated the already dire humanitarian situation in the impoverished coastal sliver, threatening the socioeconomic welfare of people in Gaza as much as their health.
We are afraid that the new coronavirus wave will result in new lockdowns that will only worsen the economic conditions. The situation is also very dangerous because of the high population density in the Gaza Strip.
The coronavirus is taking heavy toll on us because of the blockade and the lack of resources. Things are really tough, and we are in an urgent need of medicines, hospital supplies, and vaccines.
The Israeli blockade and multiple wars since 2007 have had a devastating impact on Gaza's health sector. Local authorities in the tiny enclave have been desperately fighting to prevent the spread of COVID-19.
Since early March, infections have started to rise. The first wave of coronavirus ended during February, and at that time the curve of infections was flattened. The results were also stable and the numbers of critical cases were moderate. During March, we started to witness a rapid increase in infections and critical cases.
People here are bracing themselves for the worst as COVID-19 infections continue to increase.
The small enclave has been under a crippling blockade since 2007.
Experts say the Israeli siege must be fully lifted to help avert a humanitarian disaster. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
While on a visit to Europe, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has been discussing the Iran nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, with senior EU officials.
I welcome the Secretary's reaffirmation that the U.S. is ready to engage and the prospects of a U.S. return to the JCPOA.
For his part, Blinken seemed only interested in spinning anti-Iran rhetoric following meetings at the European Commission Brussels.
We talked about our shared goal of preventing Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons.
Earlier, at NATO headquarters in the Belgian capital, Blinken spoke at greater length on the subject.
To look at how we might come back to compliance with the JCPOA, we said yes, and to date, Iran has chosen not to engage. So, as we've said, the ball is really in their court.
Even Iran's harshest critics might find Blinken's position difficult to grasp. After all, it was the U.S. that withdrew from the agreement in 2018, at a time when Iran was in full compliance, according to the International Atomic Energy Agency. Many analysts believe Joe Biden's administration is bowing to pressure from Tel Aviv to not engage with Iran. It has been suggested, however, that Benjamin Netanyahu does not speak for everyone.
There's many parts of Israeli society and even in the authorities that believe this deal will be better for Israel in the short, medium, and even longer term.
The U.S. continues to impose illegal unilateral economic sanctions on Iran, despite the JCPOA having been underpinned by the United Nations. Tehran insists the current deal cannot be renegotiated, and the only fair and legal option for the U.S. is to rejoin the accord without preconditions. As the coordinator of the deal, legal experts say the ball is firmly in the EU's court and not Iran's. According to many analysts, Iran has demonstrated it is unwilling to remain in the JCPOA at all costs. Therefore, they say, the EU is clearly running out of time to save this landmark agreement. Jerome Hughes at the European Commission, Brussels.
As the UK races ahead with its vaccine rollout, discussions have turned to normalising large public gatherings such as sports events, cinemas and theatre shows. Britain's Culture Secretary, Oliver Dowden, has revealed that the government are now considering COVID passports to allow people to attend large-scale public events from June the 21st.
We'll be testing whether we can use COVID certification to help facilitate the return of sports. Obviously, final decisions have not been taken on that, and I'm working with the Chancellor of Duchy of Lancaster, Michael Gove, who is leading on our COVID certification work programme. But I think that is a potential tool that could help the return of the things that we love.
Campaigners have been quick to push back against such proposals, adamant such a move would restrict people's right to refuse any form of vaccination. More than 300,000 people have signed a petition against COVID passports, citing MP Nadeem Zahawi, the secretary in charge of the vaccine rollout, who said there were no plans for vaccine passports back in December 2020. Last week's unease over potential blood clots being linked to the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine added more anxiety. In Brussels, the EU have announced similar proposals to facilitate freedom of movement within the bloc. Their digital green certificate would allow their 450 million residents to travel freely between nation states, one of the essential four freedoms that make up the European Union. This has become critical as a third wave of infections continues to spread. The digital green certificates will apply to tourists also. British holidaymakers who've been quick to book their European getaways are finding themselves having to get vaccines and COVID passports before travelling. Turkey, however, have come out and declared they will not be imposing such criteria, a marketing ploy designed to attract vaccine-weary holidaymakers. Concerns over vaccines and human rights will remain ongoing. Anti-vax campaigners will continue their crusade, but those in the entertainment industry, as well as countries reliant on tourism, will be desperate to get their economies back up and running. In this vein, many feel vaccine passports will ultimately become part of the new normal.
in the limelight.
Critics contend that Facebook continues to disseminate false information that can lead to violence, a conclusion that some had reached even before the breach of the Capitol, says Chris Walker, writer in an article published under the heading, Facebook failed to prevent billions of views of pages sharing false information. More than 10 billion views of content on Facebook pages known to be from sharers of false and misleading information could have been prevented had the social media company acted earlier to try and curtail the dissemination of such posts earlier in the 2020 presidential campaign. That's the conclusion from a report produced recently by Avaaz, an organization that describes itself as a global web movement to bring people-powered politics to decision-making everywhere. Facebook failed by waiting until October, very late in the election year, to alter its algorithms in order to prevent the spread of disinformation during the last leg of the presidential election season, Avaaz suggested in its findings. The group's study was based on observations of pages deemed to be the 100 most prominent spreaders of misinformation during the run-up to Election Day. Avaaz defined such pages as those which shared at least 3 pieces of misinformation over 90 days and refused to correct themselves after receiving Facebook fact checks. Though, in actuality, on average, these pages shared around 8 pieces of misinformation without making corrections during the designated time period. Not every post from these pages was necessarily misinformative. Rather, the 10 billion figure from the report is citing the number of times that any content from the pages recognized as carrying misinformation were viewed. Avaaz noted in its report, however, that the 100 most popular posts from the pages that were known to have been false were viewed around 162 million times on their own. The organization also noted that these numbers were just the tip of the iceberg, as many other Facebook pages shared similar content. This is not the whole universe of misinformation, said Fadi Quran, a research director at Avaaz who worked on the project. This doesn't even include Facebook groups, so the number is likely to be much bigger. We took a very, very conservative estimate in this case. The misinformation both before and after the election had real consequences, the report from Avaaz said, as the kinds of false information that was shared tied directly to the attack on the U.S. Capitol building on Wednesday, 6th of January. Facebook created the conditions that swept America down the dark path from election to insurrection, the organization's report stated. The social media site has claimed that it is committed to stopping the spread of misinformation and said that it was labeling and flagging posts from pages and politicians alike if they contain false or questionable information. Critics, however, contend that Facebook continues to disseminate false information that can lead to violence, a conclusion that some had reached even before the breach of the Capitol building. Carmen Scurato, a senior policy counsel at the digital rights group Free Press, wrote an opinion editorial for Truth Out in late November, describing how Facebook had failed in its purported mission. Carmen Scurato noted that statements made by former President Donald Trump, for example, falsely claiming that the election